From PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A. Popular music has become a controversial topic in America today, and while it's true that each generation's musical expression causes distress to some even as it pleases others, feelings about contemporary music are especially deep and divisive. For many, the sounds they hear have more to do with hatred than harmony, and are a sort of verbal aggression that overwhelms rather than uplifts. Understanding how we arrived at this state of affairs is a complex and engrossing tale, one that has much to do with our history and our attitudes about race, sex, and art itself. My guest is Martha Bayliss, author of Hole in Our Soul. Martha, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here, Martha, and it's a great book, if I say so myself. Two of the major themes in the book are these, according to my reading. First of all, that something has gone terribly wrong in American popular music and that its traditional affirmative nature has degenerated. And the second point is that the African-American musical idiom is central to the historic development of American popular music in our society and has traditionally demonstrated some very important traits and qualities. What are they historically? I mean, what does the African-American musical tradition meant?
Well, I hate to start with a correction, but I use the term Afro-American to describe the music. And there's been a lot of misunderstanding that I'm saying only Black Americans can play this music and that kind of stuff. I'm not really using the term to describe the musicians, but to describe the musical idiom itself. And I argue that American music's distinctiveness, there is a lot of American music that is not particularly touched by the Afro-American influence, but its distinctiveness in the world, I think, is very largely due to that touch and that history. I draw upon the work of Henry Pleasance, who is a music critic now quite elderly, living in England, who compared the Afro-American idiom in the 50s and the 60s and more recently to the body of modernist music created in the European idiom, including serialism and 12-tone music, and concludes that the best of Afro-American music is the best of modern music. Mm-hmm. And his description of the idiom is sort of my starting point. Of course, I drew on a lot of other sources as well. I guess a couple of the key elements would be rhythmic counterpoint, or rhythmic harmony, as it's sometimes called, a subject that's greatly misunderstood because a lot of people think that rhythm in music is simply a pronounced steady beat.
Yeah.
Well, you can find that in Baroque music and you can find it in inane rock music,
mm-hmm.
neither of which has what I consider to be the rhythmic component that's distinctive about Afro-American music.
Help a layperson understand that, Martha. When you say rhythmic harmony, I get a sense of a complexity of harmony.
Yeah, it's not always that complex. I wouldn't make a brief for complexity being an abstract good in art, because some of the greatest art is extremely simple.
Mm-hmm.
But it has to do with it. The best comparison is with harmony itself, as we understand it, in that there is what is called a structural beat, which is a steady pulse that's more or less metronomic in the way that students of the European idiom can understand. But in addition to that, there are other rhythmic elements that exist in a kind of tension and a kind of interplay, a very kind of elastic interplay with that structural beat. And it's not simply that they subdivide the beat, you know, sort of little ticks fitting into bigger talks. They, in fact, sometimes don't fit in evenly to the structural beat. They dance around it. They tend to slow it down. They tend to speed it up. They tend to sort of interact with it,
right,
in the same way that different tone values will interact in a chord or in a complex harmony. And this, obviously, there's no question that this comes from Africa, where it is an extremely highly developed part of their music. Some would say developed to the exclusion of any other element in music, although that's not really true. There are melody and harmony in Africa, but not in a way that compares with Europe.
Right.
But on the other hand, European rhythm doesn't compare with African rhythm.
That's a very good point, too, and I'm sure we'll be coming back to. Because, well, you tell me, what then is there about this music that makes it of appeal to a wider audience and ultimately used and abused by that wider audience?
Well, partly, historically, I think it has to do a little bit with timing, because this idiom made its debut in the world. I mean, it was certainly present in American culture in the South. It goes back to the 18th century, the 17th century. The music of the slaves was appreciated by the whites. I think in some ways that genuine appreciation, and again, and this doesn't mean that they had progressive social views. It simply meant that they appreciated what the slaves could do to entertain them. So there's been a long appreciation in America, but when it comes to sort of entering the world and entering world culture, European culture, and the sort of highbrow culture, that really didn't happen until the beginning of the 20th century, and it was largely a function of recording and broadcasting. And that was also a time, the turn of the century, when Romanticism was, you know, at an extremely attenuated, sort of exhausted, and very self-indulgent phase.
Right.
We'd gone from Wagner and Mahler into lesser, there was a kind of exhaustion of Romanticism in music. But there was also a very high seriousness about music. And so it's not surprising that Afro-American music made its way first as a popular music, something
yeah.
that was looked down upon. But I think what it offered to anybody with ears was a kind of antidote to the exhaustion of the Romantic style. And some of the European modernists were seeking a similar antidote.
Mm-hmm.
And they were drawn to jazz, early jazz, for that reason. I think the antidote, what were the elements of the antidote? Again, it was a kind of, I argue in the book, and I've never heard anybody argue this, except maybe Henry Pleasance. It was a kind of return to the classical virtues in music. It was, and I mean classicism as opposed to romanticism. Wit, clarity, playfulness, elegance. And with this very, very attractive rhythmic component that had been really, really out of European music in the Romantic period. Rhythm was just gone.
Again, that's well said and evocative, as it is in the book, Martha. But let me see if this also goes with it, because if I mention the word sensuality, I might argue for that, and I think one could say that. But that also becomes something of a sort of factor of various interpretations,
that's
is it
right.
not?
That's mm-hmm. right. That's a big theme in the book, mm-hmm. as you know. There is the connection with the rhythmic element to bodily movement. That in its, you know, as I said before, that's connected with a style of worship, certainly in the African context and definitely in the North American and the South American slave context, that rhythm was also used as an aid to work. We forget that a lot of this music came out of work songs. It's amazing how much that has been forgotten. That the music was a way of moving the body. And European music, except for maybe the waltz and the polka and some folk musics, I don't think European music could do that in quite that way. It was a really new thing. The early craze for Afro-American music, for ragtime and early jazz, they were dance crazes, very overwhelmingly dance crazes, because suddenly people were able to move in a different way to the music. Now, I love to dance. I have that streak in me. And so I can understand that. And to me, it is not necessarily related to sexuality, except in the way that all physical delight is related to all other physical delight. But there's a kind of puritanical reaction that you find in European culture, and certainly in America, to bodily movement itself. This is a thing that goes back in forms of worship in this country and elsewhere. And those dance crazes were condemned and damned and worried about and fretted about as being, you know, sensual and
right.
suggestive and mm-hmm. and going to drag our youth down and so forth. But to me, that's the reaction of a puritanical culture
yeah.
to something that is simply bodily.
I think you're quite right about that and indeed quite honest on it in the book. But I also get the sense there's very much of a projection of attitudes
mm-hmm.
onto people. For example, one of the most striking points I learned was that this, again, to use the word sensual expression of the Afro-American tradition and its musical expression was part of life, seen as a whole, seen as something as kind of a healthy expression of a natural physical force. But to perhaps a more repressed audience, it looked like lasciviousness and was then portrayed at that. So you get to get this projection. And I think one of the points you make is that the mirror image of Puritanism is often pornography, which I found striking.
Yes. Mm-hmm. See, I don't say that European culture, English culture, American culture is entirely puritanical, that that's all there is to it. There have been a lot of countervailing currents and countervailing tendencies. But we do have a streak in Protestantism and in Christianity in general of body hatred, of you know, the flesh is evil, and sexuality is inherently sinful. Mm-hmm. Bodily functions are inherently unclean. That is definitely, it's an ascetic strain in our culture. A lot of cultures have this strain, but it's been rather pronounced in European Protestant Christianity. I don't think there's anything like that in African culture, but that doesn't mean it's a lascivious, untrammeled, sexually liberated,
anything goes,
promiscuous, mm-hmm. Animalistic existence. To me, the sort of repressive culture and the pornographic culture are, as you say, they're intimately related, because once the controls are off, people will go to the other extreme if they were brought up with a repressive attitude.
Right.
Whereas if sexuality is worked into life in a way that's can be tolerated by the human frame,
mm-hmm.
and I hesitate to use the word healthy, but in a healthy way.
Yeah. I think it's a good word.
In a way that allows it its place,
mm-hmm.
but channels it in a constructive as opposed to a destructive direction, then you don't have this dichotomy from one extreme to the other. And I see that middle ground being elegantly and beautifully set forth in a lot of this music, when the music's good, which is not to say that I love to see sexy stuff in music, and more the better. That's not my attitude. It's the kind of eroticism that's in good jazz and blues, even really salty blues, is as you say, it's very tied to the rest of human experience.
Yeah.
It's tied to the emotions. It's tied to the mind. It's tied to right and wrong.
Yeah.
There are countervailing tendencies against puritanical repressiveness about sex. I talk in the book about the expressionist movement in Europe, which was a sort of revolt against repressive. D.H. Lawrence, all the sort of currents coming out of late Romanticism and moving into modernism of erotic liberationism, which mm-hmm. is the phrase I have for it. Those currents encountered this attitude about blacks and about race and sex and embraced the stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, the terrifying primitive was the liberating primitive.
This embrace, and I like that word, is one of the key points of the book for me, because here, what we've been talking about meets another force.
Mm-hmm.
And here you're very clear about, again, putting things in the wider context and discussing these artistic trends as they were developing. Modernism being, I think, one of the primary developments here. And it came in three types. The one I found most particularly, and of course all three merit discussion, but the one I found particularly compelling in terms of this embrace and its use and where the story goes next is perverse modernism. I mean, do you agree with that as a kind of a focal point of what happens in the story?
Yeah, perverse modernism is my term for a collection of impulses in the modern arts, the visual arts, the theater, literature, to some degree music, although actually most of the influential things have come less from modernist music than from the visual arts and theater. It's a collection of impulses that recur throughout the 20th century, some even earlier, some at the end of the 19th century. I just mentioned expressionism. One such impulse to lead into it from what we were just talking about would be the erotic liberationist sort of the use of obscenity and exhibitionism as part of theatrical performance for its shock value, with the idea that the best way to get people out of being repressed is to shock them, force it on them, and sort of instantly liberate them. And it tends to present sex as an ugly thing, The Expressionists had a strong sense of shame about sex because they did come out of a repressive culture, Austria and Germany, the end of the 19th century. Middle class, bourgeois, high bourgeois, German and Austrian culture. They were quite repressed about sex, and so when they tried to break through, there was a strong element of shame and the conviction that sex was something ugly, unsightful, and unclean tends to cling to it. Part of what we were saying before.
Exactly.
And that is recurring. D.H. Lawrence tried to turn that around. He really worked on that. That was his great theme, was that, you know, sexuality doesn't have to be ugly, and letting it out doesn't have to be a disruptive and destructive thing.
But he's swimming against the tide.
Yeah, and he ended up going a little crazy. But there are others having to do less with race and sex and all that than with art itself and the role that art plays in society and what is an artist.
Mm. Tell me this, Martha, because I say this with trepidation because it's a bit presumptuous on anyone's part to take a 400-page argument and try to reduce it to a one-liner, as they say. But could it be said, at least helpfully, simplistically, that at the point where where perverse modernism becomes a force, and I think we're clear on that being a century-long kind of tradition, and meets the Afro-American music tradition, we're often running into a direction that ultimately leads, and here I'll use the very provocative word, to a kind of a decadence of the form.
Yeah, a lot of it has to do with changing attitudes about what an artist is. The attitude that they had toward being an artist was very, very different than the attitude that European modernists have in several respects. Most, I'll just sum it up, it really has to do with an attitude toward the audience and toward commerce. Most Afro-American musics, with the exception of gospel, have been commercialized to some degree from the very beginning. It's one of the few areas in this business-oriented culture where black people could make money and run a business and get somewhere. So there's been a very strong embrace of commercialism in Afro-American music. When Louis Armstrong died, I think it was Ellington who said, "I loved and respected Louis Armstrong. He was born poor, he died rich, and he never hurt anybody on the way." Mm-hmm. You know, there's an embrace of money-making, of being an entertainer, of being in the business.
Martha, there is a lot to talk to you about, and let me just take a moment away from the program to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of PRI, Public Radio International. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest today is Martha Bayliss, author of Hole in Our Soul. Martha, I think one of the points that's made that's very important to everything we're talking about here is that the Afro-American tradition, as you describe it, includes a lot of forms of music made by a lot of different people. And I think the country and Western figures in here, for example, we should make that very explicit. It's not just music by black people for black people. Far from that. It's much more inclusive than that. And I'd like to bring our story into one of the most evocative and powerful chapters in the whole story, and that is the British invasion or the British period in which they became so enamored of the Afro-American tradition and using it. The names of groups come to mind, and none more so than the Beatles and than the Rolling Stones. I think you make some strong points about the difference between these two groups.
Yeah, I think there's a big difference. Mm-hmm. The Beatles are more kind of working class embrace of American rock and roll, Chuck Berry and some of the blues, not too much real hard blues, but some of the more swinging blues. The Beatles grew out of a universal movement in Britain, which began with the folk fans, but then became quite widespread, which was called the skiffle movement, which was a set of simple instruments that anybody could learn how to sort of beat out a rhythm on. And they would sing anything that they knew, any American song that they knew, whether it was a rock and roll or a jazz standard or anything. They all mixed it up together. And the working class mixed it up more than anybody because they weren't particularly purist. They were less purist than the more educated. So the Beatles were a skiffle group. They were called the Quarrymen, and they were in Liverpool. And Liverpool was a real music town because of all the Americans who were there in the port coming in and out. They had a lot of record stores, a lot of clubs, and the Beatles were big fans of American music. They knew quite a lot about it. So when they made their name, they came on in the eyes of some of the more elite in Britain as what was considered a pop group. meaning rock and roll, meaning this was commercial, this was American, this was vulgar. And the Beatles ingratiated themselves in lots of ways because they were clever and they were campy and they made jokes about the Queen. And they managed to win over a large segment of the elite audience. And their music was just really quite good.
And it became a worldwide phenomenon, obviously.
Yeah, but there was another segment of opinion in Britain that resisted the Beatles, that saw them as pop, saw them as sort of, I hesitate to use the word kitschy, but saw them as too commercial, too American, or not... really, it's just too commercial. It's hard for us to understand because we think of 50s rock and roll as authentic and 50s pop as being this commercialized stuff. To the Brits, it was all the same thing. And in this second segment of opinion, you had a kind of rejection of the Beatles as being too pop.
And is this where the Rolling Stones find
this
their
is
entree?
The Rolling Stones came out of. I think they were a group that were status anxious. They resented the elite culture, but they weren't really part of the working class culture either. And they really got into the blues. And my argument about the Rolling Stones is that they, twofold. First of all, they defined themselves, or rather their manager, Andrew Luke Oldham, defined them very much in contradiction to or opposition to the Beatles. It was a deliberate contrast to this image of the Beatles as good boys,
right,
as pop, as fun, as cute with their cute little haircuts and pleasing the audience. The Rolling Stones interjected a different set of attitudes.
And does this not, Martha, bring us to a very pivotal point in the story? Because it seems to me, again, simplifying obviously, but that at this point we began to set off on that progression of ever harder versions of rock expression. Things I must confess I know a little about, but the heavy metal and the various forms of that progression.
Yeah, it's again, it happens on two levels, the non-musical and the musical, or the extra-musical and the musical. In the extra-musical level, the Rolling Stones really changed the attitude. Musically, though, I think they remained pretty loyal to the blues, with the exception of Mick Jagger's singing. He's not a blues vocalist, really. But the bands they put together were... They're not that bad as sort of imitation blues bands. I like a lot of the Stones' music, and I think they wrote some good songs. But at the same time, that impulse toward the blues carried a freight of, I think, misunderstanding. Because, first of all, the kind of blues they gravitated toward were the Chicago blues, which were that is itself a standout form of blues because it's particularly hard. It's not as swinging, it's not as soft, it's not as laid back or understated as a lot of other forms of blues. It's the hardest form of blues, it's the most aggressive form of blues. They seized upon that to the exclusion of any other blues sound.
Mm-hmm.
And then they exaggerated it. The Rolling Stones sped up the sound of Muddy Waters.
Right.
And then came along these other groups, these so-called power trios, the guitar-centered groups, who did away with the piano, did away with the harmonica, did away with the second lead guitar in many cases, and stripped it down to a lead guitar, bass guitar, and drums, and stripped the sound down to something much more, you know, they would have said lean and hard driving. I would say repetitive, limited, and without subtlety.
Well, it sounds to me like what we're getting is a hardening of musical forms and a hardening of attitudes.
Yeah.
Simultaneously.
Yeah. A real shift of attitudes.
Mm-hmm.
And a simplification and hardening of the musical sound, which the blues is all about nuance. The sound of the blues is all about mixtures of tones and subtleties and shadings and ironies. And playing the blues is something you learn how to do after a long, long, long apprenticeship.
But this development, again, as is depicted in the book, is in its historical context. In that, is this not also, Martha, the period of the happenings and sort of the expression in its era of perverse modernism in various ways, again, sort of coming to the
parallel
fore?
To this. Now, I don't think the Rolling Stones were particularly affected by happenings. And I don't even think the early rock groups, the trios that made this hard sound, were particularly affected by happenings. They were affected by the general attitude that the artist was an outcast, that the artist was a rebel, and that the artist, you know, would give an obscene gesture to the audience as soon as smile at them if he thought they didn't understand him. Those were old avant-garde attitudes. A lot of these guys picked them up in art college.
Martha, to conclude a conversation that's been tremendously enlightening to me, I'd like to ask you a kind of a philosophical question, because I think it's been a very strong undercurrent in all that we've talked about, and it's probably to do with this, the relationship between art and morality, when you get down to it. I mean, does art have a duty to morality at all? And if so, and that's a vast question, if you could just give us an insight into what it may be.
Well, I'd like to be able to build into that my answer one comment, which is the one musical movement I left out is punk. Punk is the epitome of perverse modernism in rock. Punk occurred in the 70s, first in New York and then in Britain. And I couldn't possibly have this conversation without stressing the importance of punk. Punk is the epitome of anarchistic, nihilistic, in-your-face shock as an aesthetic, as the purpose of art. And the legacy of punk is everywhere. It's in grunge rock. It's turned heavy metal into something much more offensive than it might otherwise have been. The punk sensibility is really dominant now. And I call gangster rap blackface punk. And you can trace the development of gangster rap and show the punk influence. I do that in my book. So I don't want to stop short of saying something about punk. But that leads into your question because, you know, the punk impulse is really the sort of final attenuation of or extension of everything that I've been calling perverse modernism, which really has its root ultimately in the detachment of art from any other consideration. It's art for art's sake, you know, the idea of art as a law unto itself, of art as being above other human enterprises or concerns, including religion, philosophy, and anything else that people do. That is a very strange idea of art when you look at it cold. And it comes out of the late Romantic and the modernist period in Europe. It's rather unique in the world. It's not found in any of the other cultures of the world that I know of. And it started with the idea of a religion of art, but the religious part of it has sort of fallen by the wayside. And we've inherited, some people would blame it on Nietzsche, we've inherited this idea of art as generating, or the artistic personality as generating morality of its own, respecting no law. You know, it is a law-making force. And we, that's a mighty, mighty radical, mighty extreme view of art. And yet we accept it. We go around daily, we sort of accept it in our culture. And I think it should be looked at. Because I think certainly the West and certainly the rest of the world and certainly the Afro-American culture that developed in America all take a different view of art, a more modest view of art. Do not put art on a pedestal above morality and above other human concerns and give it this legislative power. They don't. And in the great battle that I'm describing between the Afro-American musical culture and perverse modernism, that is a very key point. It's a very central concern because the Afro-American musical tradition is rooted in much older ideas of where art belongs in our scale of life and of values.
And that is something I think we should treasure and we should remember. And thank you for reminding us of it. Thank you for being with us today on Dialogue.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Martha Bayliss, author of Hole in Our Soul. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Assistant producer is Dennis Saunier, and our technical director is John Tyler. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Radio Smithsonian. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For a cassette copy of this program, or for more information, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. That's 1-800-747-7444.
PRI, Public Radio International.